Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Okay, so welcome back, everybody, to Behind the Knife. We are very excited to have our second debate. We've had a tremendous amount of success with the first debate, and we appreciate everybody's input and all your suggestions out there. Tonight, we're going to discuss a different topic. We're going to discuss the patient that's not too unfamiliar, the patient with perforated diverticulitis, the one we get called oftentimes in the middle of the night. We're going to talk a little bit on two sides. What do we do with this patient? Should this be somebody we should pursue a more conservative agenda and include diversion? Or is this somebody that we can do a primary anastomosis on and avoid the problems associated with a stoma and a subsequent stoma takedown, or maybe even no stoma takedown at all? So I'd like to welcome to the show. First, we have a new member of Behind the Knife, and that's John McClellan. John, thanks for joining us.
Hey, sir. Yes, excited to be involved. I've been listening to the podcast just starting my research year. I think it's a great project and lots of good debate coming out of it.
So John is also a resident along with Jason and Kevin, and I am proud to say he is another one of my 99th percenters out there, and very happy to have him join the cast here. And now on to the more important part of this discussion, our two participants. So I'd like to welcome into the octagon, first of all, Dr. Howard Ross. Howard, welcome to Behind the Knife.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here, Scott.
So Howard is the chief of the Division of Colorectal Surgery. He's also the surgical director for the Digestive Disease Center at Temple University Hospital, and he's also a professor of clinical surgery at Temple University School of Medicine. And Howard is going to be talking a little bit about the more conservative management, and his opposing figure is Neil Hyman. Neil, welcome to Behind the Knife.
Why, thank you, Scott. Dominate the podcast.
I love it. So Neil is a professor of surgery. He's also the section chief of colorectal surgery and the co-director of the Digestive Diseases Center at the University of Chicago in Chicago, Illinois. So, gentlemen, we really appreciate you taking the time out and joining us on Behind the Knife. So we will get right into things, and we will start off with this. And first up, I'm going to ask Howard, you're going to go first, and we're going to talk to you a little bit about why in the world I get called in the middle of the night, and the not uncommon scenario is you're called in perforated diverticulitis, or you're called in for somebody who has free air or septic, and we get in there and boom, we got that bad diverticulitis with a perforation. Why would I go ahead and why would I divert every one of these patients? What's wrong with primary anastomosis, and why is diversion the way to go?
Well, let me just say a few things. First, it's an honor to be here with Neil Hyman. As a member of the American Society of Colorectal Surgery, I have always thought that Neil Hyman represents really one of the true innovative thought leaders in our field. So it's really a privilege to get to speak with him today. The other thing that's quite a privilege is that Neil's published a lot on diverticulitis and ostomies, and I can use his evidence against him, I hope, though I'm sure it will backfire. So I will tell you first that I've always believed and I've always been trained that our goal was to help save lives. And we certainly know that if someone has perforated diverticulitis and peritonitis, they need an operation or they will die 100% of the time. And we know quite well that if we resect the colon and bring out an ostomy, overwhelmingly, they're going to live. Though clearly there's a mortality with the diagnosis of perforated diverticulitis. It is a life-threatening injury. And we have an operation that can help us save lives. So anything that we do really has to improve that outcome, meaning we can save the majority of lives of patients who have perforated diverticulitis with resecting the bowel and making an ostomy. So sure enough, Neil Hyman goes about and in 2014 publishes a study in the American Journal of Surgery called Complications of Hartman Takedown in a Decade of Preferred Primary Anastomosis. Now, I don't know what decade that preferred primary anastomosis is, and we'll talk about that because I don't know that we're actually in one. But clearly he lays out the complications of Hartman procedure. 29% complication rate. Many patients have two complications. There's a significant mortality, two deaths, four anastomotic leaks, and 103 of his Hartman reversal patients. So he well spelled out the risk of making an ostomy in these patients. And clearly the desire for patients not to have an ostomy, but we know it saves lives, so we still do it. Why wouldn't you make a primary anastomosis? Well, there's a lot of data for that. Clearly, putting the bowel together in the base of pus and potentially an unstable patient who might get more unstable has always been a situation that we worry about as surgeons. So I'm going to stop here for a minute, but I think that we have an operation that saves lives, which is a resection. Though an ostomy and an ostomy takedown has a lot of complications, we know we can save people's lives with that, and that's the gold standard as of this moment.
Well, I think it's important that you always start off by buttering up your opponent. I appreciate that aspect of it, Howard. And Neil, before we get into what Howard had to say about it, talk to us a little bit about the opposite side. Why should we be doing a primary anastomosis?
Sure. Well, just a couple of disclaimers about the buttering up. Howard, you still can have my Bud Light. And in any case, I just wanted to tell you in all seriousness, Scott and Howard, what a privilege it is to participate with you guys. I think it's important. I think one of the things we're going to talk about is for especially the residents, this is an area, the whole area of diverticulitis, no matter what we say, is we know almost nothing about it, and our treatment options are largely based on superstition rather than evidence. You know, the issues really to me are as follows. It's pretty straightforward, actually, in this particular issue that we're discussing. I completely agree that there are a subset of patients, for example, the older demented patient whose quality of life would be better with a Hartman procedure. I agree with a colostomy. I certainly agree also that hemodynamically unstable patients who are in multi-organ failure is another time you don't want to do a primary anastomosis, because if the patient leaks, you know, when the patient deteriorates, if they're already in organ failure, you really don't know if it's your anastomosis versus the pre-existing sepsis. Having said that, that's the minority of patients. That's the minority of patients. The rest of them, we have no business doing a Hartman operation on them. It's a horrid operation. It's horrible, because the fact of the matter is, of course, it's true we need to save their lives, but we also want to make them glad that we saved their lives. And I think that it's important to understand the following issues, that with a Hartman procedure, at a minimum, a third, probably more of these colostomies that we're going to make are going to turn out to be permanent. That's first. Secondly, as Howard alluded to, the takedown is very morbid. When we looked at Hartman takedowns, that the operation, and everybody's been in one of those horrible Hartman takedowns, in our series, there were cases that lasted 6 or 7 hours taking down a Hartman. There's a high risk of inadvertent enterotomies. Although some are straightforward, it can be a miserable, difficult operation, especially with a short stump. Why would you choose to go back into a post-peritonitic abdomen? And then in the issue of the modern patients we operate on, especially the morbidly obese, it's no picnic in a fixed and indrawn mesentery making a left-sided colostomy. And very often the stoma becomes stenotic, necrotic. And so, but I think more to the point, so those are reasons you wouldn't want to do it, but there's no reason to do it. There are Avogadro's. Remember that number, 6 × 10², comparative trial showing that primary anastomosis is at least as safe as performing a Hartman procedure. Admittedly, many of those suffer from the risk of the potential for selection bias. But on the other hand, we now have randomized trials. We now have grade one evidence. There are two that I'm aware of. My four, one is, I believe, Swiss, and the other is Italian, that basically primary anastomosis was associated with diminished complication rate, diminished cost, less OR time, less length of stay. And although we say Hartman, my last point is a Hartman, it's a two-stage operation. It's never almost never a two-stage operation. There's a 30% incidence of incisional hernia after the Hartman. If you do a Hartman takedown, it's probably 50%. A lot of them get small bowel obstructions. So I think you're making many patients are going to have a permanent colostomy. And lastly, I think this is the most important thing of one of our other studies, is that the operation the patient gets depends on who's operating on them. So that the Hartman procedure is done for the convenience of the surgeon, usually a surgeon who knows they're not going to have to do the Hartman takedown. That's not a good reason to make that choice for a patient.
Okay, thank you for comments, Dr. Hyman. Dr. Ross, do you have any rebuttal comments to this?
Well, I have some additional comments. First, Neil spoke about a prospective randomized trial, and he's absolutely correct. The trial that's most commonly quoted in the literature is that by Oberkalfler from Switzerland. This was in the Annals of Surgery, Volume 256, Number 5, November 2012. And it was a multi-center randomized trial looking at primary anastomosis with diverting loop ileostomy as protection versus the Hartman procedure. And in fact, 90% of the ileostomies ended up being closed, while only 57% of colostomies were closed. So it was significantly different, your likelihood to have an ileostomy closed that was protecting a primary anastomosis than an end colostomy. So if the end result of all of the diverticulitis was both to save someone's life as well as restore intestinal continuity, you were much better with a primary anastomosis than with a diverting loop ileostomy. This is interesting data and very compelling. This is a prospective randomized trial. However, most other data in this arena, as Neil said, suffers from selection bias. So sure, primary anastomosis looks safe, but you have to match apples to apples, and it's very, very difficult to do so. So most surgeons who are risk averse have a difficult time changing their treatment paradigm because they know sigmoid colectomy and colostomy works. But again, there is multi-institutional prospective randomized trial looking at this, and indeed the data is significant with regard to the opportunity or possibility of ultimately closing the ostomy. 90% of ileostomies are closed, while only 57% of colostomies were closed. Severe complications in this trial were also different, and most of it happened from the colostomy closure. Dehiscence, sepsis, bleeding, anastomotic leak, all different. And in fact, the length of stay at the primary operation was shorter if someone did primary anastomosis and proximal diverting loop ileostomy than if they did a Hartman procedure. So there is a growing amount of quality evidence to suggest that indeed primary anastomosis in the stable Hinschi 3 patient with proximal diversion is a safe alternative to the classic teaching.
Well, that's a little bit of a hedge on there, but can you talk a little bit, Neil, what your response to Howard's is?
Sure. Well, I think, there's certain things that are evident. Nobody would rather do a Hartman takedown than a skin-level ileostomy closure. So I don't think anybody would dispute that taking down a loop ileostomy is a much less morbid operation than repeat laparotomy, lysis of adhesions, repair of inadvertent enterotomies, and colorectal anastomosis. I don't think anybody would dispute that. So why do that to another human being? And I think at the end of the day, Mike Stamos and some of the data from shows that that's what we're still doing in the United States, despite the compelling evidence that in stable patients with primary anastomosis with proximal loop ileostomy is safe and in the long term leads to less morbidity, we continue to do Hartman procedures. And it's really a shame. And I think it's just choosing to get out of the belly faster and to do, not worry about the next time. But, for the patients, they suffer the cumulative morbidity from the multiple operations. And I think in Europe, for quite a long time, they've favored, or at least in many places, have clearly favored primary anastomosis. And it's about time we started doing the right thing for our patients.
Yeah, I think part of the issue is that surgeons aren't aware of the literature. And even if you look in the state of Vermont, where Dr. Hyman was most recently, in 2014, he published a paper, Surgeon, Not Disease Severity, Often Determines the Operation for Acute Complicated Diverticulitis. And it looked at the operation performed for perforated diverticulitis in the state of Vermont of colorectal surgeons versus general surgeons. And of the colorectal surgeons, 40% of the time, they made a Hartman procedure, while in a similar group, 68% of the general surgeons. So I think that there's possibly it is who's going to close the colostomy, but I think part of it is also awareness of the literature or the growing body of evidence that suggests primary anastomosis with or maybe without proximal diversion is a safe and more appropriate alternative.
Right, so let's think about the case Scott gave us. So there's the, you know, if anyone's in the OR doing it tonight in the modern era, it wouldn't be surprising if it's, you know, some 280-pound, 35-year-old diverticulitis we're getting, you know, more and more in younger patients. And they're hemodynamically stable, they probably are, and they have free air and they need to go to the operating room. My God, is that, you know, remember, you can bring a loop ileostomy out of just about anybody. It's no picnic. It's no fun. You mean trying to bring a stoma out of somebody like that. So I would even argue that it's safer and it's easier. Just don't automatically go to the Hartman procedure. Somebody like that, you know, you don't have to bring the colon to the outside. Do the sigmoid resection, do the anastomosis, and make a loop stoma. It takes about 10 to 15 minutes longer. But I mean, again, I would even argue in that situation that the initial operation is less morbid and less likely to run into trouble. And I mean, what are the odds of a 280-pound man not ending up with a ventral hernia after two major laparotomies? So I just think that we just, you know, again, and we can bicker about the role of laparoscopy in this situation, but we're talking globally population-based. I think that, to me, primary anastomosis with loop ileostomy in stable patients, especially the younger and healthy patients, especially the obese patients really has to be considered the standard of care if we're going to practice evidence-based medicine.
So you're saying based on evidence-based medicine, Dr. Neil Hyman is in the operating room at 1 o'clock with a morbidly obese guy, pus is everywhere, thin, watery pus, the patient had peritonitis but was stable. Instead of bringing out that stoma and ending the day, you're going to put an EEA in, do an end-to-end anastomosis, and diverting loop ileostomy. That's what you're saying.
Yes, we don't have to get into so much anastomotic technique, but my personal preference is I do the resection. I do a running proline single-layer hand-sewn anastomosis because I think stapled anastomoses are somewhat more prone to stricture. You don't have the issue of putting the stapler up through the, you know, rectum full of stool, whatever. I do a hand single layer, almost like the same technique for an aneurysm, bring a loop ileostomy. And I think one other thing I think we could all agree upon is that especially in patients who've had previous surgery, that these patients really need to be marked for their stoma. Remember, if you're going to do a Hartman, a very high percentage of the Hartmans, the colostomies are going to be permanent. And what a shame, you know, to make somebody have to walk around with a stoma they can't care for that leak because we didn't mark them preoperatively and put the stoma in the right place. I think that's another important technical point.
Thank you, gentlemen, for those great opening comments. I do have one follow-up question, though. What about the degree of contamination and perforation in patients like these, and how does that play into your operative planning?
Well, for me, is that, again, as I think my introductory comment is at least how I approach this, and again, we can maybe get into this later about some concepts in general about diverticulitis, but if the patient is hemodynamically unstable, you know, with organ failure, then, you know, the question is if they progress, it becomes very hard clinically to know if you have a leaking anastomosis. But what I'm saying is if somebody almost irrespective, and we're talking about Hinchey stage 3, purulent peritonitis, I think feculent peritonitis, and later when we get into lavage also is probably a separate issue. But I think for the usual patient, the far more common diffuse purulent peritonitis in a hemodynamically stable patient who's not in renal failure, who's not on pressors. I think, primary anastomosis with loop ileostomy is, I believe, the preferred treatment. Certainly, it's my preferred treatment.
And just Howard, to define term, Hinschi criteria to look at diverticulitis, Hinschi 1 is a patient with pericolonic or mesenteric abscess. Hinschi 2 is a pelvic abscess. Hinschi 3 is defined as diffuse purulent peritonitis, and Hinschi 4 is feculent peritonitis. So just so we have our terms correct.
So let's go back to Howard. Something you said earlier was that potentially a colostomy is the, quote, gold standard, if I heard you correctly. So are we at to the point now where we can honestly say that a Hartmann's procedure and a colostomy is a gold standard?
Well, I think it's been the gold standard. I think that it was rather poor quality evidence, but it was clearly the experience of surgeons that if a patient was dying of peritonitis from perforated diverticulitis, the sigmoid resection and end colostomy would significantly impact their ability to survive, and survival was good. The problem was the postoperative morbidity. So I believe that anything that we do has to be weighed against the sigmoid resection and end colostomy for perforated diverticulitis.
So I think we would all agree that if you're faced with a scenario where the patient's going down and they're extremely septic, that to be on the more conservative side is important. But Neil, I want to go back to something that John quickly touched upon. Why in the trauma literature, if you can get a gunshot wound to the belly and you can have stool in the belly and they can clean it up and they can say, hey, listen, 6 hours or 8 hours or whatever they want to say, you can still perform a primary anastomosis. Why isn't that the case with stool in the belly with diverticulitis, that you can just clean everything up and put them back together and go from there?
You know, I think you probably could. You know, I just think that, you know, myself, maybe because I'm getting to be an old codger, you know, an incrementalist, I'll just be very happy. I think that's an excellent question, and I think it's very possibly true. And I think that resection with primary anastomosis without proximal diversion is certainly done, you know, by some people. And I think that, you know, my suspicion is that it's fine. But, you know, again, I'll be very happy, you know what I mean, if we can convert the standard or the most commonly performed operation in hemodynamically stable patients. I'll be very happy if we switch to anastomosis with proximal loop ileostomy. They just have to undergo ileostomy closures rather than Hartmann takedowns. But I think your point's well taken.
Yeah, and I would say, Scott, that there is evidence to suggest that the primary anastomosis without diversion is even an appropriate way to go. Mm-hmm. There was a trial, however, with primary anastomosis with diverting ileostomy that was slow to accrue. So we really only have the one or perhaps two trials looking at that. But there's retrospective data from Italy and Switzerland looking at one-stage resection. And indeed, they have quite good results as well. So I think this is the volume of data and the volume of data and the lack of prospective data really prevents broad application of primary anastomosis without diversion, but it is a possibility. I think the answer to the question is why trauma patients differ is the length of time that they've been exposed to the contaminant. Most trauma patients, we'd assume, got to the operating room within minutes to hours, as opposed to perhaps longer with perforated diverticulitis.
And you know, I think that if I might add one other thing, and this is obviously just a pie in the sky and speculation, but, you know, if you take a step back, you know, we're really going blind again, driving blind, largely based on superstition, because I don't know, it'd be very interesting if anybody listening to this, I don't know anybody who even knows what causes diverticulitis. You know, I think that, you know, taking a step backwards, that there's been a randomized trial, I believe it was in England, you know, comparing patients with CT-proven diverticulitis to intravenous hydration alone, to mm-hmm. intravenous hydration plus antibiotics. There was absolutely no difference in the resolution of diverticulitis, no difference in the risk of recurrence, no difference in the risk of surgery. So it's not even clear that this is really a true infection or that we need antibiotics. So I think we don't have the first clue of what causes diverticulitis. So, for example, you know what I'm going to say, because we're so interested here in the microbiome, that it may be that the microbiome has something to do with causing diverticulitis, causing the colon to perforate. And just as Scott, you know, it may be that these alterations in the microbiome that turn out to cause diverticulitis may be the same kinds of things that would subsequently put our anastomosis at increased risk. So I'm not saying that that's true or that we should put any stock in that, but I think being that we don't really know what the circumstances were or what the pathophysiology is or why 90 or 95% of people with diverticulosis live to be 111 and never get diverticulitis, why some do, I think it makes it very hard to answer questions about whether or not primary anastomosis is safe based on logic and reasoning.
Yeah, Howard, why is that? Why is it we have a condition in colorectal and in surgery that is so common as diverticular disease and diverticulitis, and yet we still know so little about the large epidemiological studies that look at fiber intake that we used to say that, you know, fiber intake correlated, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Some other ones that the nuts and berries and can't do this. What is it about this disease process that we know really so little about when it boils down to it?
I agree with Neil and you. It is fascinating how little we know and how our treatment paradigm is so rapidly changing. We used to debate about operations in patients less than 50 years of age with diverticulitis. We used to argue about whether we should perform an elective operation after two uncomplicated bouts of diverticulitis. So we've really come full spectrum in diverticulitis being very slow to operate with non-complicated disease. And we've also come full spectrum as far as what we're going to do with perforation. Dr. Walter Colton gives a great talk on the genetics of diverticulitis and how it may really be a genetically based connective tissue disorder, and that if we could better differentiate some of these genetic abnormalities, we might be able to predict who is really at risk for perforation needs an operation and who really does not. So we're learning rapidly and things are changing rapidly, but it is amazing that it is so common, we know so little.
Before we leave this topic, please, Neil, go.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm so fascinated by this and, you know, this whole issue, in that, you know, years back when I was chairing the American Society of Colorectal Surgeons Standards Committee, is we were writing the practice parameter for diverticulitis, and it used to be for decades. Over 55, two or more episodes, operation, under 55, one. And the concept of diverticulitis was, you know, you get one, the colon sort of weakens, you get a second, it's even weaker, and geez, every time it weakens, and it's going to blow, and you're going to end up having the kind of patient we're talking about now. And I got to tell you, I was already in practice 10 years or 15 years by that time, and I said, I don't see this. You know, I just do not see this, that the patient that who came to see me, you know, after an episode of diverticulitis, they call me 2 months later, he's in the ED. And we looked at our institution, 762 patients of the 80% who didn't perforate with first episode, the risk of free perforation requiring colostomy over 10 years was 1%. And Jennifer Chapman at the Mayo Clinic, you know, it demonstrated similar things. So there we were running around operating electively on all of these people on the idea that, you know, kind of gets worse every time. And I went back, where did this come from? And the only reference I ever found was from a paper from T.G. Parks in the 1960s, you know, in which was quoted by people who would ever try and make this point. And that paper didn't make that point. That's really a paper about barium enemas in people with diverticulosis. So I'm really hoping that the young people, you know, listening to this will want to take this problem to the laboratory and rethink it and just not be willing to accept the dogma about this, because there's just so much we don't know. And if you don't know, then again, your treatment decisions and your what we do tends to be based strictly on superstition.
I would actually counsel that the patients who are not early in their training but established surgeons really try to pay attention to the changing literature in diverticulitis, because in lots of community hospitals throughout the United States, two bouts of uncomplicated diverticulitis are having elective laparoscopic sigmoid colon resection. And it is very, very frequently performed operation throughout the United States, and really no reason for it.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and that's something that I know Dave Flum and the Scope organization out in Washington State looked a little bit about, and Rocco Ricciardi talked a little bit about in terms of, has laparoscopy facilitated more resections of the colon in this area? Maybe whether that's warranted or not, that's a whole different question. But I do want to go back to one final point before we switch gears, is that Annals of Surgery paper that you brought up earlier by Dr. Oberkofler, which I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, from 2012. Interestingly, despite all of these different ones, they were recruited only 62 patients. But if I remember right, the complication rate on both groups was well over 80% or 85% kind of somewhere around there. So, Howard, is it the fear of knowing that, or to the both of you, is it the fear of knowing that your complication rate at a baseline is so high that you don't want to add to it? And maybe that's the reason, a medical legal type fear that we are tend to be more conservative, that we're going to be second guessed, we're going to be sued if they have, you know, I remember one of my mentors, Dr. Madoff, used to say, never mess up a mess up with a mess up. And is that what's going on? Or how does that whole medical legal role play into this?
Yeah, I have not been impressed throughout my career that surgeons act based on medical legal reasons. We talk about it perhaps in our private lounges or in the M&M conference, but I don't think most surgeons act on what they think is going to happen in court. I think most surgeons are truly concerned for the patient and want to do the best thing. And the problem is that tradition and mouth-to-mouth passage of, action is a very strong thing to break. So when we look at diverticulitis, you know, most of us have all these things in our head. One bout of diverticulitis, 25% chance of the second bout, two bouts, 50% chance of a third bout, based on nothing that I can find. Yet we act on this. So we perform elective operations on two bouts or three bouts. And it really takes an analytical mind and an ability to be open-minded to think maybe we don't know what we're doing all the time. I don't know if it's based on medical legal fear, but I think we act based on tradition and based on doing what's right for the patient. But unfortunately, sometimes it's time to change. And I think in diverticulitis, we really have to consider what we're doing, both on what we talked about now with primary anastomosis and then our next topic about primary laparoscopic lavage.
All right, gentlemen, I think those are great comments. I think we're going to switch gears now and move on to our next topic with laparoscopic lavage. Now, Dr. Ross, the first question I have for you is, where does this fit into the paradigm of treatment and where should it fit in?
Well, that's a fantastic question. With regards to where it fits in my practice and where it fits in, where it should fit in. And the answer is, I'm not sure. That's the answer to both. There's been a lot of retrospective data. First, what we're talking about is laparoscopic lavage for Hinschi 3 diverticulitis. So a patient with purulent peritonitis, with stable vital signs, who comes in with the need for emergent operation. It was really... I believe it was 1996 when Irish surgeons decided that if we did primary laparoscopy, irrigated the abdomen multiple liters of saline and left a drain and then observed the patient, they might be able to avoid emergent resection. There was a significant amount of retrospective data from all over the world. And then finally, published in 2014, a prospective randomized trial of laparoscopic lavage of stage 3 Hinschi patients. This was very, very high-quality data with about 39 patients in each arm. So patients would present with perforation, they'd be taken to the operating room based on their clinical exam and CAT scan picture combined. Laparoscopy was performed. If they were able to adequately irrigate all four quadrants of the abdomen, this was done, a drain was placed and patients recovered. And what they found was that the patients did very well. The primary outcome of the prospective randomized trial was reoperation. These patients end up getting sick so that they needed a sigmoid resection and colostomy. And indeed, that was not the case. Patients did very well, and they overwhelmingly avoided an emergent sigmoid resection. And in fact, only a small percentage of patients actually went on ever to have a sigmoid resection at all. They recovered completely. So I think the paradigm is changing, and I plan on increasing my my utilization of laparoscopic lavage based on my review for this debate. So I would like to stand against it. I think the points against it are that it's very hard to compare apples to apples in this field. It's our patients who are at risk, not us. We don't have a lot of data, and we certainly only have one or a few prospective randomized studies on this field. I could only find one. So I think we have to proceed with caution, but it is very, very suggestive that the treatment of Hinchey 3 periodontal peritonitis in a stable patient might be lavage of four quadrants and drain placement.
Neil, what do you think about this, and what role do you find it playing?
You know, I think Howard, I won't add more because Howard did really a terrific job summarizing the literature, and that there are numerous case theories. As Howard pointed, there's one randomized trial. There are two or three more that are in the works that should be reported out in the next year or two. You know, so I think we'll have more information. But I think, you know, here's just a couple of little quick technical points before I make more general comments. Is one, it's important, as Howard emphasized, that this is Sahindi stage three. In other words, if you look in this fecal and peritonitis, nobody thinks that you should lavage really in that situation. So let's talk about that. So again, we're talking about the situation of the patient with diffuse purulent peritonitis. In my mind, here are the issues, and I think Howard said it beautifully. You know, the really issue is selection. So the peak issues that people raise, and I think they're right, is number one, are we doing an operation when none would suffice? You know, do these patients need any operation? Have you identified the subgroup that really just needed antibiotics? Or are we operating when antibiotics alone would have worked? I think the second question is that, and this is the one that gives you the tumult and, you know, the back to the medical legal thing, is that you can die, just as Howard emphasized when he justified the Hartman procedure. You can die from perforated diverticulitis, from free perforation. And the issue is that you have to acknowledge that no matter what treatment you do, some patients are going to die. And so and go into organ failure. So the question is, if we lavage them and they get sick, can we know when the operation has failed and more is needed, or it would have been better if more has done? So said another way, if it fails, have we permitted a preventable death? And I think that's a very heavy and very difficult concept. I wanted to just make a, you know, sort of go through the rationale of this, and you know, the analogy, the reason that I personally think it's a highly rational approach is that, remember that when we operate on these patients, there's no hole. In other words, we generally do not find a hole. Like, in other words, that you see a big hole. When they have a grossly discernible hole, usually these are Hinchey stage 4 patients with diffuse diffuse fecal peritonitis. And so, you know, the issue is that it's logical, because I like the analogy of the perforated ulcer. Right, what do we do with a perforated ulcer? Usually we get in there, they're sick, they've got bile all throughout their abdomen, and we wash out the bile and the pus, whatever, and usually the patient's already put an omental patch on their ulcer. We take it off, we say, yep, there's an ulcer, and we put it back. You know, so what we've really done is washed out the contamination. And I think with diverticulitis, it's very much the same thing, although admittedly, certainly a much more microbe-rich environment. But really, it's not that they have a hole. They have a tiny hole. They have a hole that you usually cannot grossly identify. They have an inflamed segment. What makes them different from the patients we don't have to operate on is the pus in the belly. So it makes sense, you know, to me, to wash out the belly and to put a drain. So I think, to me, it's a highly rational approach. And I think that that gets back into our concepts. And I apologize if this is a little bit too tangential, edit it out if it is. But, you know, when I was training in surgery, the pre-CAT scan era, is we said diverticulitis, it's either perforated or it isn't. It isn't means that focal tenderness, and they have no free air on plane films. And then we went to an and then if they had diffuse peritonitis and free air on plane films, we said, now it's perforated. So that binary classification served us well. Yeah, with the patients who were localized went on IV antibiotics. The ones that were diffuse with free air went to the OR. Now comes the CAT scan, which basically teaches us this is a spectrum, that all diverticulitis is essentially perforated. In other words, it's just a degree. Is it a tiny, 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 tiny microscopic perforation that allows bacteria into the pericolic fat? So you get sigmoid fatitis, you know, if you will, which gets better with antibiotics, or is it anything from that to a big hole that stool can come out? So it's really a spectrum. And, you know, Ken, we talked about trauma before. I've heard Ken Maddox, the trauma surgeon, always talks about vomit, that our patients suffer from vomit, victim of medical imaging technology. And I think one other message that we want to have out is that, you know, if you have this idea of a spectrum and that they're all perforated, be interested in your guys' comments, but I certainly get a lot of calls that we've done a CT scan, the patient looks okay, and there's a few bubbles, you know what I mean, outside the bowel, locally, mm-hmm. or even under the liver, so it's, quote, it's perforated. So that means that, again, that binary concept, so I guess I have to operate, right? Or I did operate, you don't. So in other words, think of it as a spectrum, and that way you're not beholden to radiologic findings. But anyway, I find the evidence that lavage is applicable to a substantial subset of patients with Hinchey-3 diverticulitis compelling. I just don't think that we know which ones that they are yet. But I do think that, you know, again, getting back to that 38-year-old hemodynamically stable patient, you know, who's quite obese, I mean, I can't help but think that that might be somebody, just as Howard's kind of implying, that might be a good candidate for this treatment.
Now, Dr. Ross, before you respond there, you know, Dr. Hyman brought up a great point about a perforation and, you know, the colon possibly stuck to the sidewall or walled off. In your discussion, could you maybe touch on, should we maybe take that colon down or what we should do with that?
Yeah, so first off, I didn't know there were any surgeons alive that didn't operate in the CAT scan era, so I'm really excited to be here with Neil. He's truly a dinosaur. and the other thing I'd like to say is that that's part of my problem. Though as attractive as laparoscopic lavage is, we don't have a set technique as to what's appropriate. In 2014, in the disease of the colon and rectum, there was a paper published by Gustavo Rossi from Argentina, and it's called Laparoscopic Peritoneal Lavage for Hinchey-3 Diverticulitis. Is it as effective as it is applicable? And their technique, they do laparoscopy. They see if the patient has purulent, non-feculent peritonitis. They mobilize structures out of the pelvis, but they didn't mobilize the phlegma. They would perform an air test, and if they didn't see a perforation, they would go forward with lavage. If they saw bubbles coming up, then they would resect the segment. And with that technique, where they did not see any bubbles, there were 5 failures. And when they reoperated on those 5 failures, 3 had feculent peritonitis. Now, none died, so I think that suggested to them safety of the technique. But it showed that we don't know. This was a situation where we didn't unroof the sigmoid colon, but we puffed air in to look for the hole, and we saw no hole, yet those patients failed, and they still continued to leak. And then there were other papers where, if you look, another paper from Italy, Techniques in Coloproctology, 2015, what they would do is they'd do lavage, and if they saw a perforation, they're not on air testing, if they just saw it, they would close it in one layer, throw down a mental patch and 2 drains. And yet in the prospective randomized trial, they're not unroofing anything. So my concern about applying this broadly is that we don't have a standardized technique. So your question was, do I mobilize a sigmoid colon looking for the hole? The answer is I have no idea. There's no established technique. When they found the hole, one group was resecting. When another group found the hole, they would sew it. To me, it doesn't seem to make theoretical sense to remove the patch that exists over the perforated diverticulum, which is really what we're trying to do, is patch the hole and then irrigate. So I'm unsure what to do. And then the other problem we have in surgery is anecdotal. So my partner goes in for perforated diverticulitis. He's not sure whether he should unroof the phlegma or not. He was doing lavage. So he unroofs the phlegma, doesn't see a perforation, does his lavage, lays down a drain. The patient gets better, but he ends up fistulizing through every single port site that was made. So now he's got this complex abdominal wall fistula draining through four different sites. So he goes back for elective resection 3 months later, and it's an absolute mess. So he did avoid emergent colostomy, but he ended up with an extraordinarily complex situation, which might not have occurred had he just resected primary anastomosis with ileostomy or even end colostomy. So I don't think we have a set technique, and because of that, I don't know how broadly we can apply this, though it's seductive. I think we need some more evidence.
Yeah, Neil, how do you balance
for me
that?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just how do you balance that? That's a great point in terms of, on one hand, we don't want to convert something that's a contained process to a free process and miss it. But how do you balance that from somebody who's got the walled off process that antibiotics can't get to, that they can't percutaneously drain, and maybe that's where lap lavage goes. I like your ideas about a gram patch. It makes sense. You got purulence there. We can put a gram patch. But what are your thoughts on technique and converting a contained process to a free one?
Well, to me, I don't understand why you would mobilize the phlegma. In other words, you're operating to wash the pus out, you know, and get rid of the part where there has been contamination, you know, and peritonitis. At least certainly in my experience, the overwhelming majority of the time, again, there's omentum down there already. You know, there's a phlegmonous reaction. The body, you know, has been fixing itself for a long time before we came around. And I think that the body has started to quarantine the infection, and it's quarantined it. It's just some, you know, horses got out of the barn. To me, the last thing you want to do, and I agree we don't know definitive evidence, but to me, the last thing you want to do, you know, is mobilize this and look for the hole. So to me is, if there is, you know, there's an inflammatory, you know, phlegmonous reaction, you know, to me, you wash out, you just put a drain down there, and you certainly do not mobilize anything and undo the good work that the body did quarantining this. I think that, you know, again, I think that's why perhaps, you know, how and why that patient had the stool coming out of the trocar sites is because it was walled off, you know what I mean? And now it's not, you know, after it's been mobilized.
So if you go in there and you see a hole, what do you do now?
Well, to me, you know, if I go in there and I see a hole, you know, if you see an overt hole, like, I mean, there's a hole and you can see it through the scope. To me, those patients typically have feculent peritonitis. And at least until we have more evidence, I think if you see an overt hole through the laparoscope, then obviously it's not contained. To me, I'm resecting. But I would say that the majority of the time, and if you guys have a different experience, please let me know, that when you have diffuse purulent peritonitis as opposed to feculent peritonitis, there's certainly a phlegmonous reaction, and you know generally where the perforation occurred, but you usually most often do not see an overt, you know, hole. You know what I mean? That you can put your finger in or something like that.
You know, I've watched a few videos online and the great YouTube that, you know, people just sewing this hole shut. This kind of goes against, you know, what we've been taught in other scenarios. Can anybody comment on that in the realms of colorectal surgery?
I think that I don't get that. You know what I mean? These are metabolically active. To me, when you try and sew a hole in wet toilet paper, you know, you make the hole bigger. You know what I mean? I think it's kind of nice. Say, okay, I'm going to sew it. But I don't know. Every time I sew really severely inflamed tissue, you know, and it's right in. We know this. You know, we've learned these lessons. Why we put gram patches on perforated ulcers, right? We don't sew the whole closed because the stitches tear through. You make it bigger. So I don't, you know, I wouldn't say that it could never work, but I don't really understand the rationale really of trying to sew it.
So
as
I'm going to pin
anyway.
Yeah. I'm going to pin both of you down as we round up this topic, and I'm going to say, Neil, you've chaired the standards committee, and Howard, you've been on that committee writing national guidelines. Neil, you first. Our surgeons out there are looking for a way. If you had to predict where
in the algorithm of care for the diverticulitis patient lap lavage is going to take fall into? Where is that going to be?
Yeah, I think for me, it's going to at least acutely fall in three categories. The young, healthy, hemodynamically stable patient is going to be one. I think a second area, and this may be counterintuitive, is kind of, you know, that consult you get on the really old, really sick person where you know in your heart that if you operate on them, you're simply going to convert a rapid death, you know, to a slow death. You know what I mean? That you'll keep them alive more than 30 days so you can say, hooray for us, we rescued them. You know, so they can go to the nursing home for 3 days or rehab for a couple of days before they pass. You know, so I think that in the people you really don't think should have resectional surgery because they're just, you know, they're kind of have all kinds of other stuff going on would probably be the other one, you know, at least for me.
Howard?
Yeah, I think what we're going to see is in a patient with peritonitis that they are indeed going to get a laparoscopy. If they have Hinchey 3, perineal peritonitis, and they're stable and no hole is seen, I do think that lavage is going to become increasingly frequent or common. I do think that if patients need to be resected, meaning they see a hole and or tissues are normal, distal the distal target is normal and the proximal colon is normal, that primary anastomosis with loop ileostomy is going to be an accepted standard. And I do think that in the future, we're still going to have patients who require sigmoid colectomy and encolostomy because it indeed saves lives in the patient with perforated diverticulitis.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, I think also there's some talk about there about lap lavage working in the place. Patient who has smoldering diverticulitis and just can't not IR amenable for drainage and just kind of perking along, but not quite ready for the resection, but maybe just to wash them out and see how they go from there. Hey guys, I'm going to wind up this wonderful second debate with probably something we could spend an hour on in and of itself. But you have a patient, two different scenarios. You have a patient who has an abscess. They get a percutaneous drainage, whether or not you scope them or not, or they after that, and you clear the abscess. First scenario, do you resect that patient after successful resolution of their bout of acute diverticulitis with an abscess that's resolved with antibiotics and a perc drainage? Do you go on and resect those patients? And part B of that, what would you do in that same scenario of the patient who gets better on lap lavage, gets them through? Would you go back and resect that patient, or would you just follow them? Neil, you're up first.
So I would say that we don't know the answer to that. We don't have evidence, but in the absence of evidence, I don't think either one of those patients necessarily needs an operation. Again, back to the point of the spectrum of disease, you know, I don't want to punish them, really. I think that when they're better, they're better. And, you know, to me, yeah, is that it's my custom, and I do not necessarily operate on patients who get percutaneous drainage of an abscess resolved and are completely fine, and they don't have problems. I don't treat them any differently than anybody else. Same if I do laparoscopic lavage and they get well. I think that it's just somebody else with diverticulitis, and it doesn't make sense to me that they would necessarily have a more virulent history. But we need data. We need randomized. We need good evidence in clinical trials.
Howard?
Yeah, I think we clearly need evidence with excellent trials. I generally do operate on patients who've had a abscess that was significant enough to require drainage, but increasingly I feel bad about it. It's just, you know, historic data that their rates of recurrent disease and recurrent perforation is high, but it's probably lower than we believe it is. So I had been offering those patients resection, but I'm actively reconsidering that. The second scenario was what, Scott?
Same exact patient, but now it's in the setting of a lap lavage. Would it change any more? They get better following the lap lavage.
Yeah, you know, in some of the lavage papers, they looked at the need for recurrent resection, the need for future resection after the lavage recovered, and the percentage was very low. Although the study group was only about 50 patients, it was just a handful that ended up having recurrent diverticulitis and needing resection. So I have not had this in my personal experience, but I would suggest that if the patient recovered from their lavage and episode of perforated diverticulitis and were symptom-free and on enema testing or colonoscopy did not have malignancy, I would leave them alone and see what happened. I would not mandate operation.
Right. I would say in the randomized trial, Howard, if I remember right, that they followed patients out to 36 months and the recurrence rate was very low.
Very low. It's very low. And in the retrospective analysis, it was very low as well. So I'm not sure what to do with that patient who had a perforation requiring a drain, and therefore I operate on those patients. But the patients with lavage, the data does seem to suggest that they're at a very low chance of having recurrent diverticulitis requiring resection. So I would follow that patient.
Well, after those great comments, gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for joining us on Behind the Knife and all your insights into this, you know, the difficult but common situation.
Thank you for the privilege of participating.
Yeah, guys, I can't thank you enough. And I just want to remind all of our listeners out there, we are always interested in getting ideas for debates and getting experts in the field such as Howard and Neil on here and discussing some of the issues that you face on a day-to-day basis. And again, join us on Behind the Knife on Twitter at Behind the Knife, and follow us on Facebook, and also visit us on the website, and make sure on iTunes you go ahead and subscribe. And we've been as high as number one on iTunes, and we've been just most recently number 10 on iTunes, and we really need those reviews out there. And we are we're not against slumming to the point of asking that you go do it. So we thank you for all your support. And Howard and Neil, with that, we will sign off. And thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindtheknife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience. So give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. And we're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct. Sash is closed and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.